And a while back, this letter arrived, and I read it on the show. It was from Wendy Eden in Parksville. My grandparents passed this story to me, and they've been gone now many years, so I can't confirm it. Mary and Reg Morrison lived in Coombs on Station Road during the 1930s, and they told me that as World War II was ramping up and the internment of the Japanese Canadians was coming, they were gifted with two precious objects from a local family who were being forced to go away. One was their devoted dog, who my grandfather always admired, and the second was a jug. I know both were treasured for many years. The jug sat on my grandma's mantle for as long as I can remember, and I was told wonderful tales about the intelligence of the family dog. My mother became a guardian of the jug, which she treasured. I also think she may have treasured a family member by the name of Mutsuo. I have evidence of that friendship in her school autograph books, along with some quite remarkable pen and ink sketches. I believe the family had a sawmill. I may be wrong about that. However, I thought I'd throw this out to your listeners in case someone may think the story rings a bell. I would love to return the jug to the family. When you really think about it, they gave my grandparents the two things they most cared about, and one of them is here, waiting to be returned. It's been a long time, but maybe someone knows something. And that note from Wendy Eden in Parksville. Well, after that was on the show, I got an email from Jordan Stanger Ross, and he's the director of Landscapes of Injustice at the University of Victoria, and it's concerned with these kinds of stories and other things, stories about the losses of place, property, and home during the internment of Japanese Canadians, as well as the legacies that these losses still carry today. And he wanted to help get Wendy's picture back to the family it came from, and I called Jordan to find out more about their work.
Ours has been a project on the dispossession of the property of Japanese Canadians during the 1940s, which was somewhat understudied when we started almost 10 years ago on this. And we've done a lot of work on it and really see that facet of the history as really important to understanding what happened to Japanese Canadians during that decade.
When you talk about dispossession, what specifically have you been looking at, Jordan?
We've been looking at the destruction of the homes of Japanese Canadians during the 1940s. So we might often think of the internment as a temporary decision to uproot and intern people, and people often think of it as at a time of war. But what happened was Japanese Canadians were uprooted and interned, and the government was meant to be responsible for preserving their homes and businesses and property, including personal property, until the end of the conflict. And instead, first neighbors looted and stole the property that was left behind, and officials did very little to protect it. And then after about a year of that, officials decided to sell everything that Japanese Canadians had been forced to leave behind. So they had no homes at the end of the internment. Their communities were gone. And so this was a policy that permanently destroyed homes and communities. And so in our group, we think that's a really important way of understanding what actually happened in this period.
And not just homes, but everything pretty much that was in them, too, was either, like you say, taken or sold or was taken away from the families.
That's right. So there were warehouses of people's personal belongings. Lots of Japanese Canadians weren't homeowners or real, you know, we hear the word property, we sometimes think of real estate, but everyone owned something, and they couldn't take all of it with them when they were forced to internment. And ultimately, there were warehouses of Japanese Canadians' belongings that were auctioned, and hundreds of auctions, and like I said, much of it stolen, in addition to sales of homes, businesses, farms, real estate.
Why has so little been, known about this or researched about it, Jordan?
I think when we started, the perception of the era had been shaped by that very dramatic uprooting and internment of people, right? And photographs of people in shacks and tents in the BC interior winter, and deservedly so. Those were horrible things to have done, and a horrible experience for Japanese Canadians. And I think those images of people on trains and in camps, resonated with other histories that we know of internments and concentration camps during the during that same period of time. And so they drew attention, and I think that attention was deserved. But we've had the opportunity to really focus attention on this other dimension of the era and the policy that I think we also need on top of that other awareness in order to understand and learn from that history.
This is Jordan Stanger, and he is part of a program at the University of Victoria, which is looking into, well, it's called Landscapes of Injustice, and it looks into the losses of place and property and home during the internment of Japanese Canadians. And after I talked to Jordan Stanger Ross, I got in touch with Michael Abbey. He is the project manager of Landscapes of Injustice, and he followed up on that letter that I read to you earlier and has some leads about possible family connections. Part of the work he does on a regular basis is helping families find documents and photos and other things that relate to their families and the internment.
And it was amazing what the reactions were from them and things they didn't know, so they got more interested in them with their family and the history. And so it just kind of kept evolving. And then I go, well, I'm going to look at my... And I've been looking at my family, too. So I ended up going out to where my mother's family in Paldi grew up, which is there's nothing, hardly anything there. And we did find kind of through little detective work and some helper, the neighbors helped us, and I found where in the middle of the woods where my parents, my mother's family would have had a house. So there was a story about we found plum trees, these ornamental plum trees that a neighbor down in that area, he had replanted them because they're in the middle of the forest and they're really pretty in the spring. And when I took my mother out, I flew her out and she came out the year after that in 2016 from Ontario when we took her to the spot. And when she saw the plum tree, she said, oh, my mother and my aunt used to make umeboshi, this pickled plum. And so I made plums that year and I sent it back to Ontario for my aunt and my mom, and it sort of brought back memories. But I wrote about that in our Landscapes of Injustice. We have this section called Touched by Dispossession, because our project deals with the dispossession of our community by during the war when they were up interned, but also the property was taken and then held in trust and then sold without their consent. And so I put this in because it was more of like a repossession. We kind of rediscovered this tree and the house and stuff. So I wrote that in 2016. And then just about 2 months ago in September, a lady had just happened to be reading this, and she had ties to Paldi. And she wrote to me, and she said, hello, my name is Judy Koga Ross. Thank you for sharing your lovely story. I lived and grew up in Paldi and married into the Ross family from Duncan. Mary and Perry Ross held on to some dresser drawers for a Toyota family during the internment. They had promised the family it would be there here upon the return, but the Toyota family never came back to the Cowichan Valley, to their knowledge. We have a corner table which Mike Ross, my husband, inherited when he left for university. The other piece of furniture may have been sold along with the house when Mary and Perry died. If you would like the end table, it is yours. Respectfully yours, Judy Koga Ross.
And the Toyota family, your mom's family.
It's my mother's family, yeah.
Right.
She was the second youngest of 14 children, and so they had a very large stake in Paldi, and then her mother, her aunt and uncle lived next door, and they had 10 children. So it was a big Toyota clan. But the thing about that clan was the older brothers, because it was a sawmill town, they worked with their hands, and they made all the furniture, and they actually made the two houses as well. And Uncle Bob was like, he worked there since he was 13, and he would stay up late at night and make furniture for the neighbors and for the house, for the family. Long story short, they were uprooted at the war. They went to New Denver, and then the majority of my family went to Ontario, which was where I was born and raised. So I wrote back to Judy, and we had several emails, and they said, "Oh, my brother lives on in Nanaimo, but after COVID is over, we'll come and when we come over, we'll bring it to you." And I said, "Well, it just so happens we're going to Vancouver for a work thing, and they were living in Mission. Can we come and pick it up?" And they said, "Sure." So within a week, we were over there in Mission, and we spent the afternoon. They were just so lovely. They were like, it was just a really great time reminiscing about Paul Day, and actually, Judy has is Japanese Canadian as well, and so she has history both post-war and pre-war with some of her uncles. So we had a good chat about that, but they presented us with this end table that my Uncle Bob had built for the family
goodness.
80 years, like before the war, when he was you know, just a teenager. Mm-hmm. It had its sturdiest as ever and beautiful craftsmanship, and it had these two...
Is
they
that
written
the,
two
are
letters.
You just opening the drawer there now?
Yeah, open the drawer, and it says, "I lived with Marion Perry Ross since 1941-ish. I was a bedroom end table all my time away. Welcome home," the other one says. So,
oh.
So it was really great. My mom, my wife, my son, my oldest son was in town, so we went out and met them, and we've been keeping in touch. I talked to my aunt and uncle, my aunt in Ontario, and she confirmed it was that would have been Uncle Bob. So I talked to my cousin Rodney, who's the eldest son, and he told me stories about Uncle Bob making the furniture for the family, and it actually he went on to be that was his lifetime career was in woodworking because of the influence of where he was, and so it was just a serendipitous moment. So I was really excited about all these stories about dispossession, and here's a real story about repossession and a piece of furniture finding its way back. So
it's such a small part of what your family had taken away from them. But what's it like for you, Michael, to have that table in your life?
Oh, it's amazing. It's just sitting here, like, and I said to Rodney, because he's in Ontario, I said, "Well, do you want me to, I don't know when I'll ever be back to Ontario, but I could bring it." He goes, "No, just hang on to it, or we'll probably donate it to the Nikkei Nashi Museum in Burnaby," and because it has such a lovely story, but it will stay here, well-loved, I believe. And there was a little bit of a prologue to this story. The aunt that I called Auntie Katie, she's 95, but she came back in 1991 to Chemainus from London, Ontario, with her husband, my Uncle Kumi, because Uncle Kumi's brother, Shig, was the subject in the Lone Scout mural in Chemainus.
Hmm.
And so the family hadn't been back to BC for 50 years because they had just started their new life and continued on in Ontario. But because he was a Lone Scout, this mural was in his honor. They flew out the families. And when they were here, somebody came up to my aunt and said, "We have your family's furniture that we took in for safekeeping. We've been looking for you for 50 years. And so when I heard this story a few years after that, I asked my aunt, I go, "So what happened? Did you go see the furniture or whatever?" And she says, I just can't remember what happened because we were there just visiting. So this has just continued to be this urban legend, you know, just been a mystery. So
it
when
was
this,
out there somewhere.
It was, yeah. So, and so when this email came, boy, I was just like so shocked. It was really exciting.
Where do you have it in your house, Michael?
Well, it's right in my home office downstairs because I'm working remotely, but it's right here, right within arm's reach.
Hmm.
And I've taken photos of it. I've sent it over to family in Ontario. And yeah, it's very symbolic and it's very real, too. So,
mm-hmm. What's it been like for you to work with other families and, like you say, connecting them with files and helping to put this all together?
It's been probably the most rewarding part of this project. I've been with it about 7 years, and we have about four major outputs like the museum exhibit and such. But I think for me, like, this is the most rewarding. You're hearing, providing families with documents, and they're seeing, you know, get these reactions like, I always thought of my grandfather as this grumpy old man, like, you know, very stoic and quiet. But when you read the transcripts of when he went to court during the Byrd Commission to fight for more compensation for the family property that was sold for less than fair market value, and now I can really imagine what he was really like. And some people say just simple things like seeing handwritten letters for their great grandmother or grandmother, just handwritten letters or his signature and things like that. It's just, I don't know, it's been really rewarding in that sense as well.
Yes, those concrete, like you say.
A lot of it was, it's confirming stories as well. You know, they've heard about this, and one lady, she said, I heard that my family had stopped and lived for a little while on the way from BC to Ontario in this little community called Nays, which is up in the north of Lake Superior. And when she actually sees the documents, it says Nays, and not only Nays, but what bunkhouse was, what the address was, and a lot of these case files, you'll see diagrams of what the farms were like and what they were growing, and even pictures of the house. I think for a lot of people, it's filling in the blanks of the silence that we experienced from our older generation. You know, they didn't talk about it much, so we grew up not knowing about it. But now we're sort of being able to piece together stories that we did hear, and then adding more concrete information from these files. So I think that is really, in itself, pretty rewarding.
This is Michael Abbe, and he is Project Manager of Landscapes of Injustice. And that letter I read at the first from Wendy, Michael has followed up with Wendy and has some leads about possible family connections, and some other leads have turned up as well. And part of the work that Michael does on a regular basis is helping families find documents and photos that relate to their families and to the internment of Japanese Canadians. You can find out more at Landscapes of Injustice website, which is landscapesofinjustice.com.